Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Baltimore, not at all uniquely, has experienced a century of public policy designed, consciously so, to segregate and impoverish its black population. So says researcher and author Richard Rothstein of the Economic Policy Institute in a new essay on the roots of current protests in the wake of the police killing of Freddie Gray. We'll talk with Richard Rothstein about that. Also on the show, why exactly is the United States planning to expand offshore oil drilling just a few years after the world's biggest oil spill that implicated some of the industry's biggest operators? Well, you probably have a guess, but the particulars are important. We'll talk about that with Sue Sturgis from the Institute for Southern Studies. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a very quick look back at the week's press. Meet the Press's host, Chuck Todd, wants you to know he's obsessed with elections. His May 3rd broadcast featured a variety of people who may or may not run for president in 2016. There was an interview with former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, who is weighing a bid for the Democratic nomination. Republican House Speaker John Boehner was asked a series of questions, including why he hasn't endorsed Jeb Bush, what's the first thing he thinks of when he hears the name Hillary Clinton, and whether Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, or Marco Rubio have enough experience. Finally, the show discussed possible upcoming announcements, including those of Carly Fiorina, Ben Carson, Mike Huckabee, and Chris Christie. And they mentioned Senator Elizabeth Warren, who has said decisively that she is not running. Absent from the show was the candidate who had announced he was running just a few days earlier, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent who declared a run for the Democratic nomination on April 30th. The usual reason for ignoring particular candidates is that they're too obscure. But if you put stock in early polls, which you really shouldn't, four national surveys have Sanders polling higher than O'Malley. Or if it's a matter of fundraising ability, Sanders raised $1.5 million in the 24 hours after he announced, compared with Rand Paul's $800,000 or Ted Cruz's $1 million. Listeners know that FAIR is more interested in how election coverage serves the public than in how it serves any particular candidate. But on that note, it's meaningful that Meet the Press talked about voter priorities, noting that Democratic primary voters are most interested in job creation and economic growth, followed by health care and climate change. As it happens, these are all issues that Sanders has put at the center of his campaign. But Meet the Press viewers wouldn't know that from watching the show. Well, FAIR encouraged viewers to reach out to Meet the Press. What some got in return was a note from Chuck Todd pointing out that he had had Sanders on once last fall and plans to have him on again, and that Meet the Press has discussed Sanders' candidacy on its website. Looking at which candidates are discussed on the show, Todd asserted, is some arbitrary way to judge and promotes a false narrative. Well, naturally, we disagree that assessing a broadcast TV show by what is broadcast on TV is cherry-picking. Seems like a straightforward way to see what they think is important. And a look at all candidate mentions so far in 2015 would suggest that Meet the Press deems the candidacies of Sarah Palin, George Pataki, and John Bolton more newsworthy than that of Sanders. Of course, Meet the Press is not alone in pre-winnowing the field of candidates for the public to think about. A May 5th New York Times interactive feature on the election included a section on Republican candidates and a section on Hillary Rodham Clinton, as though she were running unopposed. The U.S. electoral system's a long way from perfect, so much that many people think the thing to do about presidential elections is to ignore them. Corporate media, though, will be consumed with this race for the next many months, so it seems worth pushing them to make their coverage as inclusive and substantive as possible, focused more on issues than on tactics, and interrogative of the process itself, including why so many people opt out of it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the media watch group FAIR. Mm-hmm. Public protests around a series of police killings of black people have put a needed spotlight on the experiences of many African American communities with police brutality and racism. But when protesters from Ferguson to Baltimore have a chance to speak, their concerns rarely stop at policing. On a short list of other community issues you're likely to find, substandard, segregated, sometimes dangerous housing. To the extent that that factor is engaged in public and media conversation, the explanations for it are often cursory and sometimes downright misleading. Activists and their allies are trying to push the present moment of focus into a substantive, sustained response to the myriad impacts of white supremacy on U.S. life. And understanding housing conditions, like those in the Baltimore neighborhood where Freddie Gray lived and died, is key to moving that conversation forward. Joining us now to talk about that is Richard Rothstein. He's research associate at the Economic Policy Institute and author of, among other titles, Grading Education, Getting Accountability Right. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Richard Rothstein.
Thank you very much.
Well, your recent piece that's been picked up by The Washington Post's Valerie Strauss, among others, is titled From Ferguson to Baltimore, The Fruits of Government-Sponsored Segregation. And I'd like you to explain some of the expressions of that segregation. But also, I noticed that NPR's description of your May 6th interview said Richard Rothstein talks about what he calls government-sponsored segregation. So what are some of the policies that you're talking about in this piece? And is it really just your own notion, the existence and the intention of these policies?
Well, we have a myth in this country that we have what the lawyers call de facto segregation, that we created these neighborhoods like the inner city of Baltimore that are almost all black, that are poor, that are segregated from mainstream society by accident, either because black people were too poor to move to the suburbs or because there was private prejudice or because there was white flight of people who didn't want to live near blacks. And although some of that is true, the bigger cause, the most important cause of segregation is public policy that was deliberately intended for the first two-thirds of the 20th century to separate black and white families. And segregation was a government policy. It was racially conscious. It was not the unintended consequence of benign policies. It was designed by federal, state, and local governments to segregate our communities. And this was true in every metropolitan area in the country. Now, in Baltimore, in the early 20th century, Baltimore actually passed an ordinance defining which blocks blacks could live on and which blocks whites could live on. When that kind of ordinance was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1917, the mayor of Baltimore set up a committee on segregation to make sure that even without the ordinance still being in effect, that housing inspectors, that health inspectors would enforce segregation. And if any family in a white neighborhood were to sell to a black family, the housing and health inspectors would make sure that the black family could no longer live there. And this kind of thing went on at local level for many years. Then the federal government played a major role in explicitly segregating neighborhoods in Baltimore and throughout the country. The first civilian public housing program began in the New Deal under the Public Works Administration. It was a New Deal program to create housing for civilian population, and it was segregated. The director of the Public Works Administration in the Franklin Roosevelt administration established what he called a neighborhood composition rule, which was that public housing could only be established for people of the race in the neighborhood where the public housing was established. In fact, many of the public housing projects were established in integrated neighborhoods. They tore down integrated neighborhoods and created segregated neighborhoods in their place. That's one of the things that happened in St. Louis, for example, that led to the kind of situation we have in Ferguson. That continued. Public housing continued to be segregated throughout the 20th century up until the mid-1950s. In 1949, President Truman proposed a massive expansion of public housing programs in this country. At the time, there was still a civilian housing shortage, so public housing was for whites, not just for blacks. Mm-hmm. And in order to try to defeat his public housing proposal, Republicans in Congress put forward what they called a poison pill amendment. That was an amendment that would require public housing to be integrated. Knowing that the amendment passed, Southern Democrats would then no longer vote for public housing, and the entire public housing program would be defeated. So liberal Democrats in the Senate and the House, led by people like Hubert Humphrey, campaigned against the integration amendment because they argued that if the public housing was integrated, there would be no public housing at all. And this was true throughout the country. This was not just for the South. And so segregated public housing was created throughout the country. The biggest federal policy, probably, was the policy of the Federal Housing Administration, which financed, starting in the early 1940s, builders of subdivisions, mass production builders of places like you're familiar with in Levittown, New York, or Daly City in California, and subdivisions everywhere in between. They financed builders to create subdivisions of single-family homes in the suburbs on condition that they be sold to whites only. That was an explicit condition of the Federal Housing Administration financing of bank loans to developers. So while whites and blacks were of similar incomes, returning war veterans, for example, working-class families, could have afforded to buy into the suburbs, only whites were permitted to do so. Blacks were consigned not only to urban ghettos, but to segregated public housing in urban ghettos. And those are the kinds of policies that resulted in what we see in Baltimore today, what we saw in St. Louis, and what we've seen around the country for the last 50 years. One more thing. In 1970, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development of the Nixon administration was a fellow named George Romney, the father of the recent presidential candidate. George Romney understood everything that I've just described to you, as did most people at that time. We've forgotten this history. George Romney said that the federal government had created a white noose around inner-city ghettos, and it was the job of the federal government now to untie that noose. And George Romney began a program which he called Open Communities, in which he denied federal funds to suburbs that refused to desegregate. And one of the first test cases he made of this policy of denying federal funds for sewers and parkland and water projects was to Baltimore County. And he told Baltimore County that it was not going to get any more federal funds for any urban projects unless it repealed its exclusionary zoning ordinance, that is, ordinance that prohibited the construction of multifamily dwellings in the suburbs, unless it accepted public housing with African Americans, and unless it accepted subsidized low-income housing. Baltimore County was one of the first places that he tried to do that. Mm-hmm. Eventually, George Romney was reined in by the Nixon administration because there was a white backlash to his desegregation policies. And Romney himself was eventually forced out as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And we've had nothing as aggressive in way of desegregation since. So this history is once well known. It was once widely accepted and understood that segregation was not an accident, but it was a purposeful creation of state, federal, and local government. And we've now forgotten that we think that it happened by accident. And when we think it happened by accident, we then think there's nothing we can do about it. Whereas if we understood that this was the product of government policy, we would understand that there are government policies that could reverse it.
And maybe it should go without saying, but of course, the connection between housing ownership and the accumulation of wealth is absolutely critical. So these policies explain even more than where people live.
Well, that's correct. I mean, when you concentrate the low-income population in an area, of course, they become more low-income because they don't have access to jobs. And as you probably know, in the 1950s, jobs began to move from urban areas out to suburbs because African Americans were concentrated in a noose, as George Romney said, in central cities. They had no access to the jobs that were being created, so the community became poorer than it was before. Schools have to deal with problems that would be easily handled if they were not in great numbers. That is, if any school has children who come from families who don't have stable housing or have parents who aren't literate and don't read to them often and have stress from frequent unemployment. If any school has a few children like that, a teacher in a classroom can devote special attention to those children and can remediate their problems. If you have schools where virtually every child has those problems, there's nothing the school can do to devote special attention to every child, so the whole quality of instruction declines. So all of the problems that we face today in terms of inequality by race are attributable in large part to federal housing policies that were designed to create segregation.
Well, let me just ask you finally, unfortunately for corporate media, underlying problems are often where a story ends. You know, you report on community anger about police violence, for example, and then at the end you kind of wave your hat toward underlying problems, you know, the real things that need to change, but you leave them as kind of a muddle and go on about your business. And then with the next incident, we say, oh, wow, this again, or, you know, why haven't we been hearing about this until now? Do you have any thoughts about how reporting could be useful in engaging, given that reporters are going to talk about Baltimore, they're going to talk about Ferguson? What are some of the things you'd like to see them doing more of as they have that conversation?
Well, I'd like to see them doing more of the things that you and I have been talking about, going into the history, trying to explain to their readers and their listeners and their viewers how we came to have the kinds of desperate, low-income, segregated communities like we have in Baltimore, like we have in Ferguson, like we have in cities around the country. If people come to understand this history and they understand that government created segregation and government created the concentration of social problems in certain areas, they will understand that the government not only has a responsibility, but a constitutional obligation to reverse the effects of those policies.
We've been speaking with Richard Rothstein of the Economic Policy Institute. You can find his work on their site. It's epi.org. Richard Rothstein, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Harmful impacts of climate change already happening and the devastations it's on course to cause if unchecked, along with the environmental damage and danger associated with extraction, are pushing Americans to abandon fossil fuels. So what's pushing back? So hard, in fact, that just 5 years after the disaster of the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill, the country is getting ready to expand offshore drilling in new parts of the ocean, including, to the particular dismay of many, the Atlantic coast. Well, it's no surprise that oil and gas industries are behind the drive, but the way they're exerting their private power through public officials ought to be cause for concern, and certainly for media coverage. Here to tell us about the special relationship between coastal state officials and big oil is Sue Sturgis, editorial director at the Institute for Southern Studies and author of the recent report, Drive to Drill: Energy Lobbyists Behind Governor's Crusade for Atlantic Oil. And that's the first in a three-part series. Welcome back to Counterspin, Sue Sturgis.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, how do we get from the Deepwater Horizon disaster that killed 11 people and pumped at least 160 million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico, which the judge involved in the case against BP made clear that the Deepwater Horizon disaster implicated the entire industry and not just BP, and all the public concern around that? How do we get from there to a plan for expanded offshore drilling?
Well, as you might expect, a lot of money is involved in getting from there to here, particularly from the oil and gas industry.
We know that they increased their campaign contributions. I don't think that's any surprise, including so-called dark money or outside spending that Citizens United, the Supreme Court ruling, made possible. But they did something else involving a whole new organization. Tell us about that.
Well, in the wake of the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster, it was 1 year after that that the governors got together and they formed an organization called the Outer Continental Shelf Governors Coalition. And this involved four governors from coastal states, all Republicans, primarily from the Gulf Coast, who were mobilizing to ensure that drilling didn't stop and, in fact, that it would be expanded to new areas. That was the group that they organized, and then it began, in turn, work with lobbyists for the energy industry.
Well, that's the relationship that's of concern. I mean, governors who think that drilling is in the best interest of their state and want to get together to talk about that, that's one thing. But this Outer Continental Shelf Governors Coalition is only really ostensibly led by these elected officials. It seems like in the day-to-day, in real practical terms, it's really run by these two groups with industry connections. Can you tell us who HBW Resources and the Consumer Energy Alliance, who are these people?
The way that we found out about this is, we were interested in finding out what was happening with the push for drilling the Atlantic Ocean. And so we started submitting public records requests with the offices of governors here in the Southeast, which our coverage focuses on. So we submitted public information requests to the offices of governors McCrory in North Carolina, Haley in South Carolina, and Bob McDonnell in Virginia. And we ended up getting a few thousand pages of documents. And the first box that arrived to us came from South Carolina, and we opened it up. And just about two or three pages into the stack of documents we got, we found emails that were ostensibly related to the Outer Continental Shelf Governors Coalition, but they were actually coming from a lobbyist at HBW Resources. And this is a pretty big and powerful lobby firm that focuses primarily on energy exploration and development. And they were emailing the governors to talk to them about how they could all get together and work to press for expanded drilling in the Atlantic Ocean, but also in the Arctic and the Eastern Gulf. And it was a little confusing because while the emails were coming from lobbyists at this firm, HBW Resources, they were also saying that they were representing a group called the Consumer Energy Alliance. And so we got interested in, who are these groups? What are they doing? What are they all about? And so that's where our investigation started. When we first started submitting the request back in 2013, nobody really knew who the Consumer Energy Alliance was. There was no sort of public statement that they were involved in working with the governor's group. And so we started digging, and we discovered that they're a what's known as a 501c4 social welfare nonprofit. Some people call these dark money groups or mystery money groups. It's been called a front group for the energy industry. It is ostensibly, made up of consumers of energy, but when you actually look and see at who their members are, it's, about 90 energy companies, including the five oil super majors, which BP is among them. And the more we dug, what we discovered is really it's hard to discern where HBW Resources ends and the Consumer Energy Alliance begins. You might call them sister groups. You might say the Consumer Energy Alliance is an initiative of HBW Resources. But what we discovered is essentially they have all of the same staff. They have the same mailing address. They have the same internet address as well. And so essentially the Consumer Energy Alliance is a front group for HBW Resources, the lobby firm.
Well, now, the coalition of governors, as you indicate, has always been very open about its goal of expanding drilling. What they haven't been open about is who exactly is behind these groups that they're working with, about their ties to industry. That's where the opacity exists.
That's right. That's right. When the Governor's Coalition first formed, they didn't mention anything about working with the Consumer Energy Alliance. When in fact, if you look at the records and the trail of communications between the groups, they were working very closely. And before long, they actually developed what they called a memorandum of understanding to govern their relationship. So essentially, the Consumer Energy Alliance is administering the Outer Continental Shelf Governors Coalition. It's a pretty unusual relationship. It's almost as if this public organization, the Governors Coalition, has outsourced its management to the energy industry.
It is unusual, although I think some listeners will think, well, lobbying isn't a crime. We know that industry has legislators' ear, but this is something that really goes beyond that, and particularly in terms of how someone outside, a member of the public or the media, would understand this governor's coalition. You would certainly believe that it represented elected officials.
Yes, and you would also believe that if the governors had entered into some sort of relationship with lobbyists, that we, the people, would know about that. But that was not disclosed for a while. From our research, it doesn't appear that that relationship was disclosed until reporters started asking questions about it. And then at that point, the governor's coalition disclosed only the relationship with the Consumer Energy Alliance, but they never said who the Consumer Energy Alliance was. So then it took more digging to figure out that it's really a front group for a lobby firm that represents energy companies.
Well, public polls often seem to present a public that's divided on offshore drilling, and the support varies by region and over time, depending on things like gas prices and whether or not there's just been a disaster. So what the public clearly needs is transparent information about impacts and about alternatives. But part of the services, I understand, that the Consumer Energy Alliance and HBW provide as quote-unquote volunteer staff of this governor's coalition, part of what they're doing is ghostwriting opinion columns that then run under officials' bylines. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's what we found. Also, ghostwriting lobby letters to federal officials. There's a significant amount of secrecy in the way that they operate it.
And the important point, or one of them, is not just that the industry is so involved and integrated in this group, but that there are other stakeholders that these elected officials are not hearing from, as far as we can tell.
That's true. In the documents that we obtained, we could find no evidence that the governor's coalition ever considered any information from scientists or from other stakeholders who were critical or who raised concerns about offshore drilling. And there's a lot of information out there that would be interesting from that perspective, but yet they were acting as boosters for the industry rather than as public officials trying to lead some sort of discussion with the people of their states about what is really the best way for us to proceed, what's in the public interest. Instead, it was always what's in the interest of promoting energy exploration.
We've been speaking with Sue Sturgis of the Institute for Southern Studies. The report, Drive to Drill, and there are two more installments in that series. They can all be found at Southern, when they come out, they can be found at southernstudies.org. Sue Sturgis, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.